Hello and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I'm Tyler Smith.
I'm David Bax.
And thank you for listening. David.
Yeah.
How you doing? I hear you loud and clear, and hopefully everybody hears me the same way.
Yeah, we did get some very helpful feedback about an issue that we already knew about by the time the episode posted, but we couldn't do anything about. But I do appreciate people chiming in. Hopefully we have the steps we have taken.
The journal address sounds good. I listened back to the journal, so I think we're in good shape.
Other than that, I've just been rocking out to some music on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds.
What music, David?
Well, tweakedaudio.com first is what I want to start with. I don't want to bury the lead here. The lead here is tweakedaudio.com. Yeah. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. Tyler and I use them each and every day. Today I was listening to I was trying to look up where they're from, and I can't figure it out, but a band called, I don't know if you say it Andromeda, but it's not spelled like the Andromeda Galaxy, which is EDA, it's Andromeda. So I don't know if it's like, is IDA, Andromeda? I'm not sure. Maybe it's just a misspelling, but they're a...
Andromeda? It could be that.
Maybe Andromeda. Yeah, they're a prog metal band, real nerdy stuff. It's actually a one man band. Sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds that are available at a low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Tyler?
Yes.
We're going to get into it in a minute. We're going to get into talking about our topic, which is, it's thankfully 2020 is halfway over. We are almost halfway done with this year, and everything is going to be great and bright and sunny and happy in 2021.
Yeah,
guaranteed.
That's, I do appreciate that, like, crises just really adhere to the calendar. It's the way seasons do for me, you know, like January 1st, regardless of what happens with the election or the pandemic or anything like that, it's just going to be better.
It's the same way that the coronavirus respects the mask laws in different regions of states or the country. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And mass gatherings, like church, no thank you. Coronavirus has no patience for that. If you've got political points to make, though, or important cultural points, it's got you covered. Don't you worry. Not literally, obviously.
The mask has you covered. That's what hopefully everyone is covering themselves.
Yeah. Smoking.
With a mask. Fuck. somebody's got to stop me. All right. So we're going to count down our top five movies of the year so far. But first I want to introduce, he doesn't really need an introduction. He's on the show every other goddamn week. It's Battleship Pretension editor at large, Scott Nye.
Hello.
How you doing?
Oh, you know, hanging in there, just the rest of us. I was piddling around on Twitter last night, as one does in these times with little else to do. Ugh. And came across a mask of a different sort.
Uh-huh.
That I'm very keen to ask St. Louis native David Bax about.
Yeah.
Which is the mysterious and not at all creepy Veiled Prophet Ball of St. Louis.
Yes, I'm glad.
Some kind of ritual in which a masked elite gentleman of the community picks a bride from amongst many potential options.
It's not actually a bride. But
it's something equally creepy.
It's a
creepy
mistress, actually. The guy's already married.
So when you brought this up, or when you tagged me in a tweet about it, and I was like, oh yeah, because I knew very little about growing up. I knew very little about the Veiled Prophet Society of St. Louis or the Veiled Prophet Ball. What I knew was the Veiled Prophet Fair, or the VP Fair, which is now known as just Fair St. Louis, which is their 4th of July celebration every year.
Right.
And is accompanied by a parade. The parade used to be attached to the ball, which is in December, but now the parade is attached to the 4th of July celebration. So, but to go back to the beginning for way back to the 1870s, the Veiled Prophet Society is a sort of secret society of wealthy St. Louis business and industry leaders. And they put on events like the fair. They're still involved in the fair and the parade, but the VP Fair is now called the Fair St. Louis, and the VP Parade is now called the America's Birthday Parade, which is the lame name.
Awful.
Yeah. But the Veiled Prophet Ball still happens every December. I was surprised to learn. I looked that up. And you should definitely check out back in 2014, every time like St. Louis is in the news for bad reasons, like with Ferguson,
sure,
the Veiled Prophet thing comes up again. So back in 2014, Scott Beauchamp wrote an article for The Atlantic about the history of the Veiled Prophets.
I read that article.
Yes, it's a really good article.
I'm looking at it now.
Really gets into the labor and class and race history behind the ball, behind the Veiled Prophet Society. You know, it was sort of founded to defy unions, essentially.
Right.
But the ball itself is every December, someone from amongst the ranks of the Veiled Prophet Society, meaning a business industry leader. We don't know who, except for in one very exciting case in 1972, where an activist yanked the veil off the prophet on stage. It was a Monsanto CEO of some sort or vice president. We don't know who the prophet is, but the Veiled Prophet lords over this ball where the teenage girls of society, I guess there's still a high society in St. Louis, have their...
David, as you know, I recently saw the Skulls, so I know I know all about this.
They have like a coming out and like a debutante ball, but it's a bunch of them at once. And then the Veiled Prophet picks one of these teenage girls to be the queen of love and beauty and dances with her and gives her a gift. And Scott, as you also saw, as I saw on Twitter, that you also found out that Ellie Kemper was the 1999 queen of love and beauty. And yeah, if you read the names of the queen of love and beauty, if you know St. Louis, there's names like Schnook and Bush that come up again and again that are, you know, these are the city fathers. These are the big swinging dicks of St. Louis. The thing, so I didn't have much memory of this, but I know that it was the Veiled Prophet Ball was televised up until sometime in the late 70s. I couldn't figure out exactly when it was taken off the air. So I called my mom to see if she had any memory of seeing those. And she was like, what? It was televised? Like, she was like, we all knew that was just for rich people. We didn't care, which is exactly how I, to whatever extent I was even aware of the Veiled Prophet Ball as a kid, it was the same thing. Like, that's not for us. That's for other people. But I did find a very, my mom did give me a very, interesting piece of information, which is that, my dad had a friend who was a professional artist and designer who used to design floats every year for the Veiled Prophet Parade. And one year when I was very little, my sister and I rode on a float in the Veiled Prophet Parade.
You're more tied to it than you thought.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I do have some tie to the Veiled Prophet Society, but, I don't know. Do you have any more questions? Cause that's about all I
know. I mean, I was disappointed to learn you were so unfamiliar with it. Cause as I told you on Twitter, I had hoped that this was something that the entire citizenry of St. Louis turned out in the streets for, and was on pins and needles to see who the Veiled Prophet would pick.
Well, as you probably learned from that Atlantic article, it's been rooted in class from the beginning. And so I think my impression is that there's among people like, I don't know. I grew up in a nice suburban home in a nice part of the suburbs, but I'm essentially a working class kid,
right?
You know, son of a mechanic and a nurse, you know? And so I think there is sort of this deeply rooted, like, among the working class, like, oh, that's not for us. You know, that's fuck those guys. They're a bunch of rich idiots.
Yeah. Americans are usually not as good about just saying fuck the rich. They usually want to be the rich. So I thought they would be turning up, you know, to try to be a part of their world.
Yeah, I'm sure there's I'm sure there's some of that.
Yeah. David, it sounds to me that rather than the veiled prophet ball, Oil Dorado is more your speed, which is the celebration in my hometown of Taft, California.
You told me that, yeah.
where I have very little memory of this, but it is a ridiculous thing. And it's not every year. I believe it's every 3 or 4 years. I don't know. Every 5 years. Pardon me. There's a situation where all men who are able to grow facial hair are required to grow facial hair during Oil Dorado. And I'm pulling from the Wikipedia page. I don't know how enforced this is anymore. Okay. if a man does not grow facial hair, he must pay for a permit and wear a bolo tie or a lapel pin called a smooth puss badge. If he is caught clean shaven without his badge, he may be arrested by the posse. Oh, and I can click on that, but I don't know. It might just take me to the definition of posse.
Right.
A group of men dressed in Western garb, sporting pistols and rifles filled with blanks, thankfully, and of course, facial hair. Structurally, that sentence, it makes it sound like the rifles are filled with facial hair. The man will be placed in a jail truck called the Hooskow and driven around town for an hour for all to see. Warrants may also be purchased to have somebody else arrested and placed in the Hooskow. I don't remember much of this, but I do remember Oil Dorado being a big thing. I feel like that's more your speed, David.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
The only people paraded through town are guys with smooth pusses.
But who don't have the puss badge.
Or their customary bolo tie.
Right.
Scott, do you have any, I mean, you're from, I forget, are you from Boston originally? Or
no, from
you're
Portland.
You're from Portland. Okay. But you went to school.
Went to college in Boston. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Well, of course, I'm sure Portland has all kinds of delightful and strange ceremonies and events.
Not any ceremonies that I can recall, just like weird bits of histories. I mean, the thing I always point to because it's the most absurd is that we have the smallest park in the country. It's just like a small square of grass that somebody just declared was a park and then eventually became a city park and was so declared that they shut down the street and used a full-size crane to place a tiny miniature Ferris wheel on the property the day they declared it was to be an official park. And it remains the smallest official park in the U.S.
I'm looking it up right now.
I'm glad people are keeping Portland weird.
There it is. That's adorable.
We'll get in. Let's get into the topic of the episode. But first, I want to go back to the Veiled Prophet Ball. I came up with this theory. I was talking to my wife about the Veiled Prophet Ball today because I was reading so much about it. And I came up with this theory that and maybe this sounds crazy to people now because Chicago is such a big city, but in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there really was a competition between St. Louis and Chicago as to which city was the bigger city, which city was America's sort of jewel of the Midwest type of city. And sure. Chicago clearly won that. And I think that psychologically, St. Louis has never been okay since then. I think it kind of drove a lot of us crazy. St. Louis is now, it's over 100 years after the fact, it's still like subconscious identity is a failed big city.
I think that some of that isn't true of Portland as well, because for a while it was just all Seattle on the West Coast, and Portland was seen as like Seattle's ugly stepchild or whatever. Like, we're just the cast off. Nobody cares about us. So I think that was what bred so much weirdness in Portland. Is like, well, we can get away with anything. Nobody cares about us now.
Yeah. Now, St. Louisans still want you to think of them. There's a thing that you'll find that St. Louisans, when they go leave St. Louis, will rarely describe themselves as being from Missouri. They're not from Missouri. They're from St. Sure. Louis.
That makes sense.
Because I think St. Louisans still have this thing like, we were so close to being Chicago, and we're not.
Now, I've told this on here before, but it's always fun for me to talk about. Many years ago, I was watching a VHS tape of a show called Biker Mice from Mars, and which was just one of many ripoffs of Teenage Mutant Ninja yeah. Turtles, where it's just like, okay, we need a nice long title. But anyway, it became so clear that this show originated in some capacity in Chicago, because aliens come to conquer Earth. Where do they start? Well, obviously Chicago, because, the main evil emperor or whatever, when regarding Chicago, he goes, "Ah, Chicago, jewel of the Midwest." I remember thinking like, okay, so this is paid for by like the Board of Tourism or something like yeah, that.
Did Chicago write this?
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway.
Oh man, okay. I love, we'll move on. I recently finished watching BoJack Horseman. I don't know if you guys have seen it all the way through, but a character moves to Chicago in the final season, and there are so many great, like, taking the piss out of Chicago. Like, everything that they eat is, I'm going to get some more Chicago-style French fries. Like, everything is Chicago-style. And then also there's a joke where she calls Mr. Peanut Butter. Mr. Peanut Butter is like, "Oh, are you a Chicagoan now? You know, I went to school in Chicago." And she goes, "You went to school in Northwestern. That's not in Chicago." And he goes, "You are a Chicagoan." I maybe miss Chicago. But that's not what we're here to talk about. Let's get into it, shall we? We're going to talk about our top five movies of the year so far. And because my last name starts with a B and no one's last name starts with an A, I get to go first. And so that means I get to start by laying out my, luckily there have been enough officially released movies, and by not necessarily in theater, some of them released digitally. That's fine with me. That are actually 2020 premiering movies that I didn't have to make an exception to my usual strict rule. But it does mean that there are some things that seem like they should be obvious that aren't on my list. Like The Vast of Night is not making my list, because that's a 2019 movie, but that absolutely would be on there anyway. So just wanted to lay that out. So I will start with my number five movie, excuse me, of the first half of 2020. And I believe it's my only documentary on the list. It's one I saw back at Sundance, and it's Lana Wilson's Miss Americana, which is the documentary about Taylor Swift. Specifically, its storyline is about Taylor Swift's decision to become a politically outspoken artist and celebrity. But often what I like about documentaries about individuals are the things that they reveal other than what they seem to be about. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm reminded of another Netflix documentary from a few years ago that I think it was just called Amanda Knox. It was about Amanda Knox, which is it's sort of a true crime thing about she was, I don't know if you guys remember Amanda Knox. She was the woman who was American woman who lived in Italy and was accused of murdering her roommate.
Yes, that's right.
Actually went to jail for a little bit in Italy and then was cleared. And the movie on its own is a good true crime story, but it's really about this strange woman who, even though all the evidence says she didn't do it, seems like the type of person that might murder her roommate. So I didn't mean to turn this into an endorsement of Netflix's Amanda Knox documentary, but it's worth watching. But Miss Americana, I think while I like this, the plot line that it has, and I like the way that we see sort of generationally what it means for an artist to be outspoken or more specifically, what it means for an artist of Taylor Swift's generation to stay quiet, I think is more what the movie is about. That's very interesting stuff. But what it ended up also accidentally being is for anyone who's still too cool to admit that Taylor Swift is great or is a skeptic of Taylor Swift, it's undeniable evidence of her talents as a songwriter. There are multiple scenes of her in the studio just creating that are among the best depictions of the creation of art that I've ever seen. It's astounding how quickly she can come up with the right lyric and the look on her face when she realizes that she's found the right lyric. It's a beautiful thing. And it's Miss Americana is in that way, kind of an argument for how special art is and how talent should be cherished and celebrated.
A quick question about this movie. Okay. What period of time does it cover? Because my impression as someone who is not a Swiftie is that she only became like this politically outspoken artist after this film premiered. Did she become it beforehand and I just missed it?
She became, it was the 2018 midterms was when she started speaking out. She started endorsing particular candidates. Okay. So it's really in terms of the time period, it's really the period of time that she is writing and recording Lover, the album that came out in 2019. That's really the time period it covers, but there's a lot of older footage, some very emotional older stuff. Like there's a home video, Christmas footage of very young Taylor Swift getting her first guitar as a Christmas present. It's very like, I got kind of emotional. I saw it at Sundance and in festivals, you tend to be on like little sleep and you're seeing movies. I think I saw this movie like 8:30 in the morning and I tend to be a little bit more emotional. So I remember welling up at multiple points in this movie, but that might've just been because I was in an emotionally vulnerable, state. But terrific movie, worth watching.
Oh, I would have been exactly the opposite, which anything I saw at 8:30 in the morning, it's like, oh God help you. I could see my favorite movie of the year and be like, it's not that great.
Okay, so alphabetically I think Scott is next.
Yeah, my number five is Lisa Barros de Sa and Glenn Leyburn's Ordinary Love. Stars Liam Neeson and Leslie Manville as a married couple. This is a very short movie. It's like 90 minutes long. Very soon in the movie, Leslie Manville discovers that she has breast cancer. And the movie just takes place over the course of this year of them both together and apart dealing with that, dealing with the individual steps involved in that, and reconciling that this might be a temporary thing. It might be a horrific year they go through, or it might be the end of everything for them. And it's just as kind of harrowing as that premise promises without, I think, kind of overdoing it. They have this very, this established at the beginning, this very kind of light, friendly, slightly combative relationship that's just kind of very much, I think, what a lot of couples get to be like when they're older, where they're not, you know, they've gone past the stage of vulnerabilities and are just kind of at a point of accepting one another and can lightly tease each other without like devastating the other person. So most of their conversations are kind of combative. So when they have to confront this very life-altering event, they don't really have the emotional tools at the ready in order to come together on that. And so a lot of the grieving they do is apart. And the way in which they eventually come together is at once unexpected. I don't want to spoil anything, but I think it was unexpected, especially for a film about an older couple, and very, very touching. I was just deeply moved by the film throughout. I hadn't heard of the director, Lisa Barros. I think Glenn Leyburn is either her husband or I don't think they've made films together in the past, but I hadn't heard of her before. And I'm so glad that I just kind of randomly took this press screening because I absolutely loved the film. That's all I got to say.
All right.
Next for me is a film that I actually mentioned in the most recent movie journal. So I don't want to belabor it too much, which is Spike Lee's The Five Bloods. Which, as I said, is actually not, in my view, like a perfect film. I think it's a little bit scattershot and a little bit messy, but in a way that I really like. That's the kind of Spike Lee that I enjoy. Inside Man is all well and good, but it's a little bit too organized for my taste. I like a shotgun blast of a movie sometimes, and that is very much what Defy Bloods is. It is relevant very much to the conversations that are being had today, while still, you know, when he is on the mark, like, he manages to make something that is relevant in the macro sense, while also being very specific to these characters, approaching them as, yes, representative of something, but still very much themselves. And I really appreciate that about Defy Bloods. And I think it's very, there are scenes I saw it a few weeks ago. There are scenes that have really stayed with me, scenes of unity and scenes of, you know, characters infighting and getting very frustrated with each other, and then suddenly something comes up that or they discover something that brings them all back together, and they realize that what they have in common is so much deeper than the things that divide them. And so it really is a special movie, albeit one that maybe is, this is going to sound strange, this isn't something I say very lightly, but like, it might go on a little bit too long at times, and I think it's probably a little bit self-indulgent, but I don't mind that when the passion is there and some really solid craftsmanship and some wonderful acting. I already spent several minutes in the Movie Journal praising the work of Delroy Lindo. The whole cast is great, but Delroy Lindo especially is solid. But while I think that his performance is worth the 2.5 hours alone, the rest of the film thankfully comes around that, and I think on top of everything else, it is a film about bitterness and resentment and holding grudges, and maybe even grudges against oneself, and the liberation that comes from forgiveness. It really is just a fascinating movie, and one that I think is extremely relevant to what people are talking about today. And given what I was talking about in regards to forgiveness, there might be some people that watch the film and say, no, this is not hard hitting enough. But nonetheless, it's, I really respect Spike Lee as a filmmaker, and just making movies that feel right to him. And I really enjoyed Defy Bloods.
Yeah, that fell just outside my top five. And speaking to the scattershot thing, like, Spike Lee's thought process can sometimes be difficult to trace. But it's so electric and alive. And I love that he makes the connections he makes, even if, like, they're never connections I would make in terms of, like, historical incidents or precedents or, like, ways things lead to one another. It's like, that, in a sense, it all kind of adds up. But it's what makes him so brilliant is the fact that he can relate all these things together.
I could see somebody looking at a movie like Defy Bloods or even Black Klansman or whatever, and just saying, like, well, you know, we suddenly jump into, like, documentary footage, or we jump into this, or now characters are looking at the camera, whatever it is, stuff that doesn't fit with what it would be considered, like, consistent mainstream filmmaking, but it's something that it feels right for him, and then he sells it so that it feels right for the film. And so that's what I mean when I say, like, it could be seen as very messy, but given the subject matter and just the way people are, sometimes messy is much more correct than something clean and consistent.
Yeah, I feel like terms like messy and overstuffed and self-indulgent are generally used as pejoratives, maybe more than they should be. But if there's any director for whom that sounds like a recommendation, it's going to be Spike Lee for me.
Yeah.
All right. On to my number four, which is Osgood Perkins' Gretel and Hansel, a horror movie that came out in theaters in February, I think. That is, I know among certain people, Osgood Perkins is already a bit of a star in certain like art horror circles for things like what's, and I can't remember.
It's like the black coat's daughter
The Black Coat's Daughter and I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. Both movies that I didn't see, but now I want to, because Gretel and Hansel is unceasingly strange but immersive aesthetic and visual experience. Terrific score, by the way, by a guy who just goes by Rob. That's how he's credited. He also did the score for that movie Revenge, that Coralie Farger movie from a couple years ago. Terrific score. The movie is sort of, did either of you see Gretel and Hansel?
I did.
Okay, so the movie is again, things that sound like a pejorative, it's kind of static in a lot of ways. Like, it kind of settles on a tone and stays there. I feel like there's, but I also feel like that makes even the slightest upping of stakes or tension or emotionality seem bigger, you know, more impactful, I guess is the word I'm looking for. I think it's timed just right at under 90 minutes. And there's not a single moment in the movie that feels less than considered, maybe even worried over, but in a way that I responded to. I found it to be a very transportive, otherworldly movie. Scott, you saw it. What did you think?
Oh, yeah. The only other thing I wanted to say about it is that it has a way of making its CG effects seem kind of handmade. And I can't really put my finger on like what certain technique went involved in that. It's just that when I watch it, I got the same feeling of it that I get from like watching stop motion or time lapse sequences or whatever older methods used to be used for what we use CGI for now. It kind of still had that feeling, which worked in tandem with the production design, which is so elegantly crafted and so strange and often grotesque. It never really felt like there was just a CGI layer laid on top of it, which I feel like happens a lot with horror especially.
And I should say, I think one of the performances of the year so far is Alice Krieg as the witch.
Sure.
I only knew Alice Krieg from she's in the second season of Deadwood. She's the when Joni Stubbs opens her own brothel in Deadwood, the other madam that she brings is Alice Krieg. That's the only thing I really knew her from, but she's, it's a great performance in Gretel and Hansel. And Sophia, the girl from It, is Gretel. She's really good too. Hansel's just a little kid. He's a cute, normally they're portrayed as being like pretty close like in age. But she's considerably older and he's just a little moppet, and he's got some cute lines.
I was hoping you'd say moppet. I'm very excited by that.
It was also it was shot in some weird aspect ratio too. It was like 1.55 or something.
Yeah, I think that's right. Actually, yeah, 1.55.
So it's a very strange looking movie.
Yeah, yeah, I really liked it. All right, Scott, number four for you.
Yeah, my number four is a Georgian film called "And Then We Danced." It's about, I'm probably a little loose on the plot because this is one I saw a while ago, but it's about a young man who's a ballet dancer, very determined to...
Sorry, a belly dancer?
A ballet dancer.
Oh, a ballet dancer.
No, I'm out.
Very determined to make it in, I guess, the Georgian ballet, in this very very captivating to watch kind of Georgian dance style, and very single-minded pursuit. One day, another young man joins the dance troupe and is kind of in every way better than him, even though he's less experienced, has kind of less claim over the form than our protagonist does. And so a lot of jealousy sets in right away. Where's this guy come from? What's he doing? Taking my spot in the troupe. And then with that, a little bit of attraction comes into play. And if you know anything about Georgian politics, you'll probably be aware that homosexuality is not terribly condoned there, to the extent that the film was, I don't know about if it was outright banned. At least there were attempts to, and there were huge protests around showing it. But the film very much wrestles not only with the societal impact of this guy's attractions, the fact that his career as a ballet dancer could be at risk if he pursues this, but also kind of the personal self-loathing that comes into play when you've grown up in a society that so condemns a certain type of sexuality. And I love these kind of films that kind of draw in jealousy, ambition, and attraction all in together. And this does it really, really well. In terms of, like I said, not only kind of his internal struggles, but how that gets externalized in his dance, how he pushes himself too far, how he tries to get away with it in front of his girlfriend, how his girlfriend kind of sees through that and is, you know, so often in the American version of the story, there's a moment where she tearfully goes like, go find him. But here, you know, she's in the same kind of repressed society he is. So she like outright hates him for this. So the obstacles and the struggles that everyone is facing are so much more heightened than the premise would necessarily suggest. And the director really just tackles it all exceptionally well. Yeah. And Then We Danced, I really, really liked. I don't know what its availability these days is to have a brief theatrical run. But everything is kind of in limbo right now. So if it does pop up on VOD, I highly recommend people check it out.
Okay.
All right. My number four. Now, David, as everyone knows, like a lot, you and I do not adhere to the same rules. You know, my rules are
that's true. Crazy. No one should have to adhere to my rules. They're way too strict.
Yes. And thankfully I didn't, because otherwise my my list of 2020 films would be very, very short. So this is a film that was released in, I think, Australia last year, but it was released in the U.S. here. And it is Mira Folk's Judy and Punch, which is, again, a film that is just so odd, and it just does not adhere to just basic rules of tone and story and character. In many ways it's very straightforward, but in other ways the choices that are made are delightfully ridiculous. And it is about, you know, the characters Punch and Judy, who have this very successful puppet show. Punch is played by Damon Harriman of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and wonderfully in Mindhunter. And then Judy is played by Mia Wasikowska. And they have a son together, but Punch has a drinking problem, and it eventually leads to a violent confrontation between the two of them. And Judy is left for dead, essentially. Speaking of left for dead, sorry about that. I don't know if you can hear the explosions outside my window, yeah. So there's a revenge quality, but like within all of this, it's sort of a medieval film. And so Judy falls in with like a bunch of people that have been deemed witches by society. And meanwhile, Punch continues to gain acceptance and popularity and all that. So it has these parallel stories, and Punch is our villain, or rather our antagonist. And we don't really sympathize with him, but the film does spend a lot of time with him, which I appreciate. And everything, the hysteria around witches is something that he is able to play into, because there's a showmanship quality to him and to the world in which he lives. And the film features, I won't say it's Ravenous-esque music, but it's this very intense, a sort of almost like over-the-top level of portent in the music. And yet all of this is also very funny and ridiculous. There comes a moment where a character is delivering a monologue to the city, and then just starts quoting Gladiator.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, and the film knows, like, it's a well-known Gladiator quote. The film knows that we're going to recognize it, and It just does it and then just moves on. And again, it's like,
I like that.
I appreciate the film's level of just doing like, oh, we're going to, I'm just going to make this movie and we're going to move on and everything will be a lot of fun. Mira, she's an actress. I believe this is her directorial debut. And it's got that kind of boldness and self-assuredness that can sometimes come from a first or a second time filmmaker. I really love it.
So the circumstances are too perfect for me to not resurrect this joke I made months ago, but Gretel and Hansel, Judy and Punch.
Yeah.
What's next? Isolde and Tristan. All right. Is that what's next? My number three film of 2020 so far, the last film I went to see in a theater on Monday, March 9th, not counting the press screening of My Spy, the last film I actually went to voluntarily see in a theater is Autumn de Wilde's Emma. I had to put a pause there because there's a period at the end of the sentence, or at the end of the title. This is a movie I was very excited about beforehand, and I guess lived up to my expectations. I think it's because I had seen. I largely try to avoid movie trailers, but I remember seeing the trailer for Emma. I think before Little Women back in December. The time's out, right? Probably. The trailer for Emma is very funny. And so I was excited to see this kind of like cheeky heightened take on it's Jane Austen, right? Is that right? Okay. On Jane Austen. And I think wisely the movie starts very much like the trailer. It does seem very, very heightened. You've got Bill Nighy kind of hilariously hamming it up. And the other actor who plays I can't think of his name, who plays the priest or the chaplain or whatever. Joshua Connor is his name, is also very larger than life. The movie's very funny. But then I was going to say gradually, but pretty quickly after that, it actually settles into just being a more straight-faced, respectful adaptation. And so I think that I'm not sure what that first section is maybe there to just like throw you off of what you expect from a Jane Austen adaptation so that your mind's open and then you can reapproach it, taking things, seeing things for what they are. And I think Autumn de Wilde does a great job as director. There's a lot of great use of space with these big rooms and with large groups of people, you know, cutting around large groups of people picnicking outside and stuff like that. The direction's good, but really the thing that comes back to me is performance. And Anya Taylor-Joy has quickly become an actress that I really like, and her performance as Emma is startlingly sharp and aware, and she plays the sort of cusp of adulthood very well. But sometimes she can be still a girl and can speak without thinking or act without thinking, but sometimes she can also be a more mature adult who has earned empathy over the course of her life and can understand how her actions affect people. I thought for a story that has been, I guess, the story of Emma is the basis of Clueless, and so it becomes a thing like with certain like Shakespeare things, whatever, where we just understand here are the main characters and plot points. It's just like a sort of boilerplate that other things are built on. Autumn de Wilde kind of went back to the text in a way and said, no, this isn't just a bunch of archetypes. This hasn't like congealed into something that we all can just look at once and understand. There's a full story here, and there are characters here, and there are still new things to mine from this story. Terrifically well acted by I mentioned Bill Nighy and Anya Taylor-Joy, also Johnny Flynn and Mia Goth are both very good in the movie. I like Mia Goth a lot.
I like that Johnny Flynn a lot.
Yeah, you saw it too, right?
Yeah. Okay. And the only other thing I wanted to mention with it is it does the great thing I always like in modern period pieces, where it shows somebody getting dressed into that like super restrictive gear, and you're like, holy shit, yeah, that is impossible to get ready every day. It's a good thing they had nothing to do.
Yeah. I forgot to mention one of the other best performances in the movie, which is Miranda Hart as Miss Bates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most devastating film scene of the year, I'd say. That, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I still, like, do you ever, like, there are things, I don't want to go into details, but there are things that I've done in my past that I've realized, like, I've hurt someone's feelings by being stupid or thoughtless or saying something.
Absolutely.
And everyone, and like, they will just occur to me again every once in a while, and I will just like cringe and like blush and like feel terrible about myself again. And yeah, that the scene you're referring to with Miranda Hart, I have a few times over the past month occasionally thought of it again and just felt bad for her all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Scott?
My number three, which I suspect might come up again, so stop me if it does. The Invisible Man?
Yeah, we'll get there.
Okay. Then move along.
All right. My number three is Dan Scanlon's Onward, a film that a lot of people have said is like minor Pixar, and I disagree. I think it is in the tradition of like some of the best Pixar movies out there. I do recognize that there, and you know what, in that Pixar tradition, there is like your main plot, but then there's like this sort of a sub theme of like, this is a magical world that has settled for like modern technology. But then as our main characters go on this quest that has nothing to do with that, more and more of the characters that they encounter, start to embrace their magical nature. And so it's the world building aspect of it could actually be seen as a little bit, not necessarily distracting, but a lot of time is spent on that, especially in the beginning. But to me, it didn't necessarily bother me. Instead, I just really embraced the whole vision of what Dan Scanlon was doing. And I really responded to the story that is being told. It is a very grown-up story, one that I think younger audiences probably could appreciate, but certainly older people like myself can really value. You know, in its own way, it's a dead father movie, so obviously it's going to speak to me in that way. But it also gets to this idea of, you know, when you it's so easy to define yourself by loss and by pain and tragedy, and to try to fill that void with something or try to regain something, the thing that you've lost. And in doing so, it is entirely possible to not actively ignore, but just not see what is in front of you and the people that are alongside you, or just the circumstances that you're in that are so, that can be fulfilling if you let them be. And I really, and the way that that, the way that the film engages in that is, it winds up being in its own way kind of a twist, and one that instinctively, because you're so on board with the main character and so on board with his goals, instinctively you're like, no, what, you don't realize what you're giving up. But at the same time, the film has really laid the groundwork for that to be emotionally and thematically fulfilling. All of that underneath some really interesting visuals, some really exciting and thrilling set pieces, and some very solid voice work by Tom Holland and Chris Pratt, Mel Rodriguez, who's always wonderful.
Wow.
I really responded to it on a number of levels, and I feel like I do think that a lot of people probably relegate it to, again, like minor Pixar, maybe just because it's newer and that tends to be what they do. But I feel like it's right up there with something like, you know, a WALL-E or a Finding Nemo or something like that. So I highly recommend it. If somebody, I believe it's on Disney Plus. If somebody has Disney Plus, check it out. It's worth it.
Oh, around to me again already.
Yes.
That's right.
I'm sorry. Did you want me to go on?
No, that's okay.
Okay.
So I don't know if someone else has this one later, but my number two film of 2020 so far is Josephine Decker's Shirley.
Nope. No, I was a little disappointed in it.
I'm sad to hear that. Although it's weird. I'll get into the movie in a second, but, never mind. Yeah, I was going to say that's not say something about that wasn't about the movie, but about my experience at Sundance. But I'll save it for another time. Not a negative thing about Sundance. I would never say anything negative about Sundance.
No, there's nothing bad to say about that.
It's a little chilly, right?
But I like that. I like that part of it. It's. Shirley is about Shirley Jackson writing one of her novels, but it's a fictionalized account of a real person writing a novel that became a real novel. I forget the name of the one that it's about, but
Hangs a Man.
Hangs a Man. Yeah. Okay. And Shirley Jackson is known as a horror writer, and I feel like Josephine Decker took cues from that in making Shirley, which feels like, and I feel guilty about making this comparison because it's like unwoke or whatever, but it feels like a Roman Polanski movie in a lot of ways. It's very internalized psychological horror. There's a lot of sweaty close-ups. That's kind of how I would describe most of the movie, is sweaty close-ups.
I think that's the that's like the German translation of the film, right? Like that's the title there.
I should have thought of more to say about it, but it did stick with me. It did work with me more than it did for Scott, I guess. I wish I'm suddenly like the cat's got my tongue on certain things. I think I got in my head deciding whether or not to say that other thing. And
well, Elizabeth Moss is very good in it. I like the way both her conception of the character and kind of the way her character is designed. Like, so many period pieces feel like they're just dressed for the period. Elizabeth Moss in the movie looks like those old photographs you see of people in the period, where it's like they got like halfway to the point where you're supposed to be like fully dressed and like prim and proper for the 50s or whenever it's set. And then there's like, I don't have the effort to go all the way. You know, so her hair is always a little messy. Her glasses are a little crooked. Her character feels very lived in, which I did not feel was the case for the rest of the movie.
That's too bad. So you didn't like Odessa Young's performance either then?
Her performance was good. I feel like the conception of the character was a little thin. And just on the whole, the screenplay was just very thin and has too many scenes that start and stop too quickly. It doesn't feel like that kind of descent into madness that Josephine Decker's, the three other Josephine Decker films I've seen have. It doesn't have like this, you know, a lot of comparisons have been made to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf because it has a similar thing of this young couple being brought in by this very dysfunctional older couple, and them kind of being driven mad by each other. But it doesn't have that sense of like cascading into nothingness. It feels very kind of herky jerky and start and stop. I wasn't surprised to find that it was the screenwriter's first screenplay. It just feels too like every scene has a definitive point without adding up to an entire portrait.
I see what you're saying. or I mean, I don't agree with it, but right. I see what you're saying. I found that yes, Elizabeth Moss is great, and so is. I thought Odessa Young was great too, and I mean, we're not even talking about the fact that Logan Lerman and Michael Stuhlbarg are both in the movie, and also I think both very good and have substantial parts in the movie. But the heart of the movie is the sometimes adversarial and sometimes conspiratorial relationship between Shirley and Odessa Young's character, and I guess the angst-ridden goth adjacent teen in me liked the way that the movie seems to be obsessed with, or at least the characters maybe obsessed with mortality, obsessed with their own deaths. Odessa Young's character, I think, is I think there's a history of not just movies but all fiction and literature of romanticizing, maybe glorifying the death of young women. And I think the movie kind of shows what it's like to, or at least attempts to come close to what it's like to be a young woman in a society that sees mortality in a kind of, sees their own death in a kind of glorified way.
Sure.
I don't know. I'm getting far afield and not making my point very well. But this always happens. There's always at least one movie whenever we do a countdown that I'm like, fuck, I should have like rewatched it or something before. Like I have.
No, I know the feeling.
I can't remember what year Marjorie Prime came out, but I put it on my top 10 of the year. But I still to this day think I didn't make a good case on that top 10 episode for why it should be a top 10.
It always happens with one.
Yeah.
Like when I talked about Thoroughbreds, it's like, oh, I could have done better. you know.
And I've got that Wit of the Staircase thing where now it's like, well, if we were talking Marjorie Prime right now,
sure,
I'd make a great case. Now I know what I want to say. All right. Scott, you're up next with your number two.
Yeah, my number two is Andrew Ahn's Driveways.
Yes. Which didn't qualify for me because it's 2019. Sure.
But you did see it.
I loved it.
Yeah, it's so good. So it's about a young mother played by Hong Chau who travels, I would imagine for the first time, to her sister's house with her young boy. Her sister has recently passed away. We come to understand that they weren't terribly close. They, I think the sister was a good deal older, so they didn't essentially grow up together, but they still had that kind of familial tie. Sister passed away, so she goes to hopefully clean up and sell the house, you know, make a decent profit. She's kind of well-employed, but not gainfully employed as a medical transcriptionist, wants to be a nurse, but definitely struggling for money, and enough that when she gets to the house and discovers that it is... her sister very much struggled with hoarding and the house is unlivable. She has to go stay at a hotel, which we quickly understand is a pretty major sacrifice for her to fork over the money for a cheap motel in whatever town they've landed in. Does the film even specify?
I don't think so. It does.
Yeah. We understand she comes from like what, Wisconsin or something. So it's some ways away from there.
Okay.
Anyway, that doesn't really matter. But but the house could still, you know, make her some money. So she goes through the process of cleaning it out, and it kind of does a familiar thing of becoming a window into her sister's life that she had no conception of. And while she's cleaning this house out, she kind of has to send her son off to do whatever, you know, he's kind of too young to really help in any meaningful way. So she ends up forcing him to kind of hang out with neighbors. It's brought back a lot of flashbacks to my own childhood of being shoved off on various neighbors who I didn't like, didn't understand, and was kind of sitting in their house for a few hours a day. But the boy ends up strangely befriending their next door neighbor, who is an older Korean vet played by Brian Dennehy. And
Korean war vet. He's a white man.
Sorry. That's
He's not a Korean veteran.
Specifying.
Yes.
Yes. Korean war veteran played by Brian Dennehy. And the two of them just kind of hit it off. He's a widower. and doesn't really have a lot going on other than his weekly bingo night, which he can't even drive himself to. So he's very kind of shut up in the house, just kind of watches the neighborhood go by. But they become something that the other needs at this point. Sense of company and companionship that can extend beyond the limited world to which they're supposed to exist. You know, this kid's supposed to be going out and play with the kids, but he doesn't really get along with the kids he's shoved off on. The older guy gets along with the guys he hangs out with, but he only sees them, you know, once a week to shoot the shit over bingo. It doesn't seem like he has really deep relationships with them. But the kid becomes a way in which Brian Denny can kind of impart something to the future. He has a daughter that he doesn't really understand or get along with, and we sense that there's a lot in the past between them that is difficult for either of them to overcome. And the nature of their relationship is by definition and becomes increasingly in different ways transitory. You know, the goal from the start is to sell the house, so whatever relationship they build is designed within the film to be temporary, but of course both of them become more attached than that, and when they're reminded of its temporary status, it kind of comes crashing down in a surprising way, building to really one of the most breathtaking endings I've seen all year, in part because, like the characters, you don't expect it to end kind of as soon as it does. It's really, really touching. I completely loved it.
Yeah. I mean, you've got the kid's great. Hong Chau is always great. Brian Denny's always great. You've also got Jerry Adler is one of his bingo friends.
Yeah.
And the mom of the neighbor kids is it Christine Ebersole? Is that her name?
Let's see. I have the page up. Yep, that's her.
Yeah, that's a terrific little performance too. The movie is very what's the word I'm looking for? It's shaded perfectly, very, very well observed, I think, yeah, in even small moments and with characters like Christine Ebersole's character, who is kind of a joke but is also real. You have memories of going to the neighbor's houses, like I totally do too, and she seems like the mom of the kid you don't like.
Yeah, totally. Well, at first she seems very sweet and genuine, and you're like, this seems like a decent person in the neighborhood, but she just kind of slowly unravels to be like completely clueless. I feel like we're kind of starved in some ways for these films that are very kind of authentic portraits of kind of people who are working class but aren't overly burdened by that, just kind of going through everyday struggles, and this draws out a lot of emotion from, I think, something people go through all the time.
Yeah, it's really good. Did you see Spa Night, his first film?
No, I didn't, but now I really want to. I wanted to at the time, I just kind of missed it. But
yeah, very good. All right, number two for Tyler.
All right, it is in fact Scott's number three, which is Lee Wannell's. I don't remember how you say his last name. The Invisible Man, I was excited to see it, but I did not expect it to be as just fully beautifully realized as it is. It's a great example of something that David, you and I have said many times before, which is like, if you want to make a movie that has, on one hand, you've got something like Defy Bloods, a film that has a message and is trying to be relevant to conversations happening today. And that's a very, he's casting a wide net. Whereas something like The Invisible Man, because it's a genre movie, it's like the best way to make your comment about society is to first do justice to the genre. And with The Invisible Man, the scarier it is, the more tense it is, the more... if Defy Bloods is a shotgun, like The Invisible Man is a scalpel, like it is a sniper rifle to go with the gun thing. It is so specific, so focused, and the more focused it is, the more effective it is on a thematic standpoint. Elizabeth Moss, obviously well represented on the list already, has to carry this movie. The rest of the cast is very good, but like her level of fear, determination, the questioning of herself, because there is the gaslighting concept there. It all works so well. It's wonderfully structured. It is wonderfully photographed as well, because obviously when you're dealing with an invisible man, because I think this is a movie that looks at its concept and says, okay, what, let's look at it from every possible angle and get what we can out of it. And one of the big things is you're dealing with absence, but is it actual absence? And so you'll have shots where nothing's in the frame, or the most important thing in the movie is in the frame. You never quite know, but either way, the camera will linger, because even if it's not there, it could be. And so whether it be the soundtrack, the way it's shot, the way it's acted, the way it's structured, it is so damn near perfect in every way. It works as a genre film, it works as a character study, and it works in the larger cultural conversation about the way relationships work, and in this case, and mostly in what people have been talking about, it's like the way a woman is treated. But this idea of being so possessive of another person that even when the relationship is over, in this case in a very extreme way, even when the relationship is over, that person still has a hold on you. And this idea of love being a possessive thing and feeling like, well, I love you, and thus that entitles me somehow to your love for me, or at the very least your affection or your presence in my life. And man, it just, I expected to like it. I did not expect it to just get its hooks in me and just stay with me as long as it has. I saw it on my birthday and it was like the best birthday present I could have ever gotten. And yeah. Scott, I know you like it as well. Not quite as much as I do.
Not as much. Admittedly, but you haven't seen Driveways, so who's
set? That's true.
To put it pretty plainly, the movie rocked my shit pretty hard. I was completely enthralled, and I love any movie that takes a pretty simple idea and runs all the way with it. And as many times along the way as you lose track of time and you think like, well, this is about as we've reached a good point with this story now, we should be wrapping it up, it just keeps pushing it further, but not in a way that feels like it's extending it. It just feels like you naturally need to keep descending further and further into this. And yeah, all the stuff you're talking about with craft is so on point. Just the early parts where you already know the movie you're watching. So when the camera just pans over to the other side of the room and nothing's there, you're like, well, is this the part where some stuff starts happening? It might be. Lee, what was this? Wenell, just allows that discomfort to settle in and lets us just sit with not knowing, the same way that she would, even if she didn't know she was being stalked by, even before she knows she's being stalked by an invisible man, the threat that she lived in when she was with him doesn't go away. The sense that he could be around every corner, that he's always watching her, that he's always keeping tabs on her, even if there wasn't this kind of genre thing hanging over it, all those would still be emotions she would be grappling with in some way. And so for the film to take so long and just linger in just that immediate post-traumatic stress is really remarkable. And then by the time the genre stuff starts happening, it does not stop, and it goes every direction you can imagine with it. It's so, so good.
And it also speaks to the brilliance of the sound design as well, because you're dealing with a character who obviously is always watching, but whether she knows that he's invisible or not, everything needs to be heightened when you are being monitored. It forces you to monitor everything else all the time. And so, you know, when she inadvertently kicks something, it is like deafening for the audience. I remember something that, you know, comedians, when they talk about the comics that they like, the thing that they tend to say the most is like, this comedian, it's something they say about Brian Regan a lot. Like when he finds a premise, he will attack it to the point where it's just like, there's nothing left. Like he's gotten everything out of it that he can and has made it effective. And so like, yeah, I agree. There are moments where I'm just like, I don't know where we're headed after this, because this feels like a climax to me, but then he finds another way to realize this concept to such an extent that when I think back on it, it's like, yeah, I can't think of anything left to explore. I think he handled it perfectly. And man, what a wonderful film.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Moss is the MVP of this countdown.
Sure. Yeah.
Of course, the MVP means most veiled prophet.
She's got like three or four of those things on.
All right, so we're,
they learned their lesson from that person. Yeah. They came up and ripped one off.
Yeah,
there's another one right underneath, like Robert Stack's sunglasses.
All right, on to my number one film of the year. This is another Sundance experience for me, and that's Eliza Hittman's Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. And Tyler, you talked about a movie that has an issue to address or a point to make. Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always does have that. It is a movie about how, despite the fact that abortion is technically illegal, it is very, very difficult to get an abortion for a lot of people, not just practically, if you happen to, depending on where you live or how much money you have, but also there's an emotional toll to the questions that you're asked and the hoops that you have to jump through. There's a psychological toll. So yes, that exists. The movie is undoubtedly a pro-choice movie, an argument for abortion access, but that's not why it's number one on my list, even though I agree with that. It's because the movie is such an elegantly executed, seemingly low key, but actually, universally, resonant, story. We started at the beginning of this episode, earlier in this episode, we were talking about Spike Lee and how he can be very visually virtuosic. He can be very loud. And sometimes it does seem to be this impression that that's all that's new to say in cinema visually with a camera, is something that grabs your attention. And a movie like Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, which is directed by Eliza Hittman, and cinematographer is Helena Luvar, I think is how you say her name, who has worked, who also shot Beach Rats, which is a beautiful movie. They find things to do with framing and with lighting, with texture, visual texture, that are incredibly emotionally impactful without being ostentatious. They're, and part of that is a well-placed trust in her two leads, Sydney Flanagan and I don't remember her name, the cousin, Talia Ryder is her name. Weirdly, neither have ever acted before, and yet, or at least not on film, and yet their cousins and friends, and the things that we get from them, the things that we learn from them about who they are, about their relationship to their families, their relationships to each other, relationships to their boss, for instance, because they both work together at a grocery store, the things that we get from them without any of it being in the dialogue. So little is said in this movie that is of like specific overt substance. Much more of what comes through about what the emotional journeys of these characters are in their looks or in the actions they perform for one another. There's a shot where one of them helps the other put on some makeup, and at that point in the movie, that action like literally almost brought me to tears. And the movie's full of just gorgeous moments like that are, I mean, Scott, you were talking about how, there's certain types of cinema we don't see enough of, anymore, because so much of, especially mainstream cinema, is geared toward the big sort of event, appointment, tentpole, whatever, term you want to use. I feel like Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, is an argument that there are still gargantuan things that can be done with, intimate and and not non-ostentatious movies.
Yeah, absolutely. It's another one that fell a little outside my top five, and which at first I had some doubts about. I thought it was maybe just too much of a process movie of like, well, these are the steps you have to go through in order to get an abortion. If you live in a certain socioeconomic class, if you're a certain age, you know, if you fall in this girl's circumstances, basically. But I think the way it builds her character, and I don't want to kind of give away the game of that, but the way it builds her character is very subtly constructed, but very elegantly so. What it ends up revealing about her and her own limitations, limitations both in, I guess mainly in her ability to seek help, are really touching, and I think say a lot about how people end up in these sort of circumstances of not kind of stretching out and demanding her own space and demanding what she needs, but of needing to be guided and then kind of the loneliness that comes from that.
I mentioned Sydney Flanagan and Telluride. I also want a quick shout out to Theodore Pellerin, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
The actor who's plays a just a boy they befriend while they're waiting for the abortion to happen. Who's good in the movie, but I just happen to be watching On Becoming a God in Central Florida right now. He's fantastic on that show. So he seems like maybe a one to watch type of actor.
I hope so.
Yeah.
All right. It's me next.
Yep.
My number one will be no surprise to avid listeners who care about my taste. But it's Hong Sang-soo's Yourself and Yours, which to get into my own, process of determining when a movie comes out. I typically go by US release year, unless the movie is older than 5 years, but Yourself and Yours premiered 4 years ago. So it barely qualifies. this got a digital release. It's one I've seen a few times. First saw it in 2016, saw it again a couple of years ago and seen it again since. But it is about a couple who gets into a misunderstanding because the guy is told that his girlfriend was seen like out drinking and just like making a big mess of herself in public, and she completely denies this. Meanwhile, the girl is approached by a series of guys who swear they've met her before, but she claims to have no memory of them. And it turns out maybe she has a twin, or maybe she's just making it up to mess with these guys, or maybe there's duplicates of her just being sprouted up around town. Hong Sang-soo, as always, kind of treads a strange line between very literal, very straightforward interactions that also seem to be taking place in some kind of otherworldly ghost purgatorial realm. He has a very specific touch to these that are built on kind of everyday misunderstandings, but which seem to be, like I said, just a touch surreal and a touch strange. I was just pulling up at the film's Wikipedia page and reminded that Scott Tobias said it was kind of a strange reversal on The Obscure Object of Desire, the Buñuel movie, and has kind of that same feel of any impossible thing could happen at any moment, but the way those impossible things happen will seem for a moment like real life. It has a kind of dreamlike logic where everything makes sense, only it doesn't quite add up. And the whole film ends up being a really, I think, emotionally charged and potent meditation on kind of jealousy and misunderstandings and wanting another person to, in a relationship, to be this person that you imagine them to be, but they end up being something different. And then the loneliness that comes from expecting certain things of others and not accepting, you know, kind of everything that comes with dating a whole person. It's a really, I think, thoughtful and elegant movie. It's probably my favorite Hong Sang-soo movie still. And I'm very pleased it finally came out.
I can't say much because I haven't seen it in 4 years. I didn't revisit it. I saw it 4 years ago. And I like it, but I think we had the same conversation. We talked about this on the summer movie preview episode we did, that there's a certain intentional imbalance of tone in Yourself and Yours that kept me at a distance. I like the surreal stuff, but then there's also some like stuff that I thought was more corny or self-aware.
Okay.
In a way, certain uses. I mean, obviously, Hong Sang-soo. This is obvious to people who watch Hong Sang-soo movies that he likes the zoom lens.
He loves the zoom lens.
And sometimes there are parts in this movie that I felt that the zooming was a little arch, maybe. But it's not enough to say I dislike the movie. It's just I've never been able to. I can't put it at the top of. I tend to like the Hong Sang-soo. After this, the Hong Sang-soo of Hotel by the River, and especially On the Beach Alone at Night,
right?
More, but yeah, it's still a good movie.
Right on.
All right, so for me, a film that David loved, but alas, technically a 2019 movie. It is Andrew Patterson's The Vast of Night.
Yeah.
A movie that even though I had heard good things going in, it still took me by surprise. I recently did a More Than One Lesson episode about it, and so I talked about it for a long time, and I feel like I don't want to talk that long about it, obviously, but it feels like I don't even know where to start. It's just such a beautifully realized movie, one that, despite being fairly short, is also very patient in trying to allow the atmosphere to sort of drive the characters and the story. And then, of course, as the characters are learning more about what's going on in their town, that drives this atmosphere of dread. It's interesting to me that there are people that have referred to this as a horror movie. It certainly is a sci-fi drama, but there are moments of dread, and it's worth noting that sometimes the moments of dread is just characters listening to something. Like, there's no immediate threat, but it's just the realization that these characters have tapped into something that is bigger than they are, and something that is completely foreign to what they know, which admittedly living in a small town is probably most things, but nonetheless, like, not knowing what to do with it, with information, with new information, is enough to really frighten a person. And as these characters, as the information is introduced slowly but surely, I find myself just riveted, listening very close, obviously, because sound is very important, but also really watching the actors as they listen. And, you know, as they're hearing something, I have no choice but to hear it as well. I'm not seeing, you know, we're not cutting to the person that's calling in to the radio station. So it actually does a very good job of creating, but almost by default, like an empathy with these characters. You're doing the exact same thing they are. And then I also just, I think it's a really great night movie. I know that sounds strange, but I like movies that, as a night person, especially living like in Los Angeles, back when I would drive for Lyft, I would drive at night, and just the world is different at night. There's just a different vibe, and it's not purely visual. It's just the emptiness of the streets, whether it be a small town or a city. And I feel like this film captures that very well. And also, it's this idea that it's not even that late. It's that the town is rallied around this very specific event that forces the film to be tremendously lonely, even though these characters aren't officially alone. At any moment, they could go to the high school gym and be surrounded by people, but they are alone in this quest. And I just really appreciate the film's commitment to crafting a tone by creating a sense of geography within the town, and really putting us in the position of these characters. And and then also the other thing that I really like is that it's a movie that is, it's in its own way like a TV show about characters listening and hosting the radio, you know. And so it's like this celebration of, you know, media throughout the ages and the way they all come together to show the way characters can connect with one another, the way, you know, these characters connect with callers, the way they connect with each other, and then we connect with them through a screen. There's just so much going on in this intimate, small genre movie, and I just love it so much.
I think I am one of those people who has described it as a horror movie.
I wouldn't have a problem with that, certainly.
But I hadn't thought, I mean, you're right about it being in multiple different ways, a night movie. I'd never thought of that term before. But one of my favorite things to do, as much as you know I'm a champion for the theatrical experience and the sanctity of seeing a movie in the theater, when it comes to horror movies, my favorite way to watch horror movies is alone in the middle of the night. And that's how I watch The Vast of Night. And the scene where Gail Kronauer is telling her very long story about her son. Is that right?
Yeah.
Literally skin crawling. I had the shivers from watching that scene. But also what I love about, the other thing I love about the movie this is going to be very, nebulous. But I've said before that all I'm looking for in a movie or any other sort of art is to not be bullshitted. I'm looking for the artist's truth. I'm looking to believe that they believe what they're saying. And a lot of times when movies have flashy or very, you know, I mentioned the word arch before, I mentioned the word ostentatious, as pejorative so far in this episode, when movies have those types of touches, I'm often like, is this director just trying to show off? But there are things in The Vast of Night, like the picture dropping out and us just having a black screen and talking, that I can't say that I know what Andrew Patterson is thinking or what he's trying to do, but yeah. I believe that he believes that that's meaningful. I believe that that means something to him, that he's not just, won't this be a cool trick to just have the picture fade out. I believe that he believes it, and that's enough for me.
I feel like I'm in very good hands the whole time, and he's not doing some, you know, I mean, for any time somebody makes like a first or a second film, there's always the potential for them to show off simply because they can, but not show off, but like experiment. And there's nothing wrong with experimentation. This is a film that does engage in experimentation, but I agree with you. I feel like he knows why he is doing it. He may not telegraph it to us. He may leave it to us, but I don't think he's doing something solely because, hey, what the hell? Neat. I get to make a movie. Oh boy. It's nothing like that. And yeah, it just, like I said, I had heard how good it was going in, and it still surprised me how great it was.
Scott, your turn to naysay.
Oh, I haven't seen it because,
I thought you had. Oh, right. Cause you don't have Amazon.
I don't have Amazon, and as soon as they want to, you know, step up and let people pay for it, I'd be more than happy to. But this idea that, as this topic for another day, but the increasing subscriptionification of movies is the most worrying trend for me, because I don't want to subscribe to five services to watch the new movies.
Absolutely. Incidentally, my documentary, Real Redemption, The Rise of Christian Cinema, is available at faithlifetv.com, $5 a month.
That is a topic. That is a topic for another day. We should definitely talk about that. Does it bother you more because you're not a subscriber? Like, cause you have Netflix. Are you bothered by the fact that The Five Bloods is only on Netflix?
I'm bothered by that ideologically. Yeah. Obviously not literally, cause I can still watch it, but like, I guess I'm bothered by the whole system, where there's suddenly three new major streaming services within the last 6 months that are debuting movies, and now with the pandemic, increasingly so. And that's only going to increase. You know, I had Netflix and Hulu because they were on the ground floor, and they're like the original people in that racket. But the idea that we all need to keep up, we all need to become TV people just to watch movies. No, one and done. You pay for it once.
But here's the workaround here is that paying for 1 month of the thing is about the same as a movie ticket.
Sure, but
so
then
just
I gotta
do that
track.
And cancel it.
I don't like keeping track.
Okay, well, that's, see, this is the nanny state liberal here. It's everything done for him.
No, I just want to pay a price for one movie.
Yeah.
I go up to the ticket counter, want to say one, please, and then that's
the
extent of my exchange.
Yeah, exactly. You're a free market conservative, as it turns out. But it's interesting, actually, because... like, a 100 years ago, studios would, if a theater or a theater chain wanted to show like one movie with like a big star, studios would be like, okay, yes, you can do that as long as you,
right,
get all these other movies that no one will want to see as well. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of what they're doing now.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see, there's a certain cyclical nature to things. It does bother, you know, I mentioned jokingly my film, like I did ask if it would be possible to make it available simply to rent, through Faith Life. And, I think they opted for not, partially because like it'd be $5 to rent, or you can subscribe for $5, but yeah, then you have to keep track. And I just like the idea of give somebody the option. Hell, make it $6 to rent or $5 to whatever it is. But like, I do like the idea of, it's like, I'm on board with watching this movie, not with what your whole platform does. Yeah. You know what I mean? I have no doubt that there are people that would enjoy or have enjoyed my film that would not at all be on board with what Faith Life TV does. You know what I mean? And so, but by subscribing, I feel like I'm bashing Faith Life. They've been very good to me. Don't get me wrong, but it is a Christian service. And so I, you know, as we've been publicizing and stuff, I recognize like there are people who might not want to review the movie because for somebody to watch it, they need to subscribe to a Christian service. And maybe this person's not on board with that, as opposed to just making it available to rent, a one-time thing. And then it's, you know, we endorse this movie and that's all, you know? Yeah, so I'm also kind of on board with you.
Yeah. It's also just the idea of like a movie should exist more than one place at some point in its lifetime. Like people were railing against the idea of Criterion releasing Netflix movies. They're like, that's ridiculous because everyone has Netflix. And like, to an extent, that's true. But should that be the only place a movie lives? No.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, I'll probably just do the thing where if I want to watch Greyhound, I'll sign up for Apple TV and watch it and then cancel my subscription. Look, there, we got bigger problems. That's my...
that's true.
Okay, as long as I'm on a movie podcast, we kind of don't.
Okay. Well, we did the episode. You guys, we did the episode about the top five and the episode about the streaming services. And the episode about the veiled prophet.
Yeah.
That's right. With a little supplement of Oil Dorado. Don't you worry about that.
All right. Well, you can find us at battleshippretension.com. I didn't review anything this week. Sadly, there's no reviews on the website this week. Nothing came out the 4th of July weekend that I really know of.
By the time this comes out. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, you can repost my review of The Truth, which
will be
streaming by the time people listen to this episode. And you can just rent that like a normal person. No subscription.
Yeah.
Just pay your price.
There you go. Find Scott's review of The Truth at BattleshipPotential.com.
By the time this airs, there should be a review of The Beach House, which I believe is a Shudder exclusive, at Battleship Retention. So, yeah.
Now, okay.
See, this conversation, it's just going to keep coming up.
I know.
So, we review things.
Tyler, so far this year on BattleshipPotential.com, there have been reviews. I reviewed the Night House.
Yeah.
At Sundance. You reviewed The Lodge.
Yeah.
Now you've got The Beach House. In a few weeks, I'll have a review up of The Rental.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be a trend this year.
Yeah, and then obviously there's townhouse is coming up. Outhouse, doghouse. And then before you know it, you're Tommy Lee Jones in The Fugitive, just listing all the places where Richard Kimball could be hiding.
All right, so that's at battleshippretention.com. You can email us at david@battleshippretention.com or Tyler@battleshippretention.com. You can follow me, David, on Twitter at Davey Pretension. You can follow Tyler on Twitter at Tyler Pretension. Tyler, you mentioned you did a More Than One Lesson episode about The Vast of Night. Anything else to plug?
This week I am on friend of the show, Mike Siegel's Travel Tales podcast. Ooh. Talking about my trips to New Zealand and various countries in Asia and Scotland and all of that. And it was a good time. So you can check that out at the wherever the Travel Tales website is.
And Scott, do you have anything to plug?
Yeah, I just literally before we recorded this episode, I recorded an episode with the Great Hearing Cast crew about La Ventura. So look for that either by the time this episode is up or very soon after.
Not to let the cat out of the cat, any cats out of any bags for the Patreon listeners, but that's a top 10 movie of all time for me.
Hell yeah, it is.
That firework agrees. Fireworks for La Ventura. All right. Well, thank you for being here, Scott.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time. Bye.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.